Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to IJ's live call to discuss our new project on immunity and accountability. I'm Melanie Hildreth. I'm here today with IJ President and General Counsel Scott Bullock, who will be hosting our conversation. We're joined by IJ Senior Attorney Bob McNamara and Senior Director for Communications Justin Wilson. Thank you for joining us. Scott?
Well, thank you, Melanie. Well, most listeners probably received my email last month where I announced the launch of an exciting new initiative for IJ, our project on immunity and accountability. And this afternoon, we're going to talk a little bit about what this issue is, why IJ decided to get involved in the fight, and finally, how we're going to move this project forward. And needless to say, this is a really big topic, and we will only be able to touch briefly upon some general issues today, but rest assured, everyone will be hearing a lot more about this topic and IJ's involvement in this coming year. So just to set the framework for our discussion, immunity is the doctrine that shields government officials from having to pay damages even when they blatantly violate someone's constitutional rights. And just as egregiously, because the officials don't have to pay, courts then usually don't even have to decide whether anyone's rights were violated in the first instance. And like with so many other issues, when you try to explain immunity doctrine to a non-lawyer, most people are stunned that such a concept even exists in America. Immunity granted to government actors is completely different than the questions raised in just about any other type of lawsuit one might hear. We like to use the example of what would happen if your neighbor intentionally threw a ball through your window. Or maybe to give an actual recent case involving a current senator, maybe your neighbor tackled you in your front lawn. So in a normal case, a court would figure out what the neighbor did, decide whether he or she violated the law, and if the person did, hold the neighbor accountable. But let's say the neighbor is an FBI agent or a state environmental official. They intentionally threw a ball through your window. Now you would be in immunity land, and where the question is not whether the agent or official violated the law, but whether the law was clearly established, and we're going to be talking about that during this call. And if there was no previous case holding that it's illegal for agents to throw baseballs through your window or tackle you in your front lawn, then you're probably not going to be able to prevail. And so this issue was arising actually in a number of our own cases, especially in our fines and fees work and our work on civil forfeiture. In fact, we just had an argument today in the Fifth Circuit on one of our forfeiture cases where we sued the Customs and Border Patrol, and the issue of immunity arose in that argument. And this is an issue that's been hotly debated and where there's a lot of concern about it from across the ideological spectrum. And our friends at Cato and Reason have been writing a lot about this and kind of sounding the alarm. So we determined this was an area that really needed our attention and where we thought we could make a real impact on the law. So we had a roundtable discussion about this among practitioners and academics who are really steeped in this. We started writing amicus briefs to build our expertise in the area. We highlighted immunity questions in our short circuit series and blog and in our podcasts, the short circuit podcasts. And just last month, we filed our first in a series of cases on this issue. So with that kind of broad stroke introduction, let me turn to Bob McNamara to give a little bit more detail about immunity and how this arose in the law. And I think it's important to note maybe at the outset, Bob, that immunity is found nowhere in the Constitution.
That's exactly right, Scott. Nothing in the Constitution provides this sort of immunity doctrine. And in fact, at the time of the framing, it was very common for people to sue government officials and say, you trespassed on my land, or you broke my stuff, or you killed my cows. There are a lot of 19th century cases about killing cows. And the kind of immunity we're talking about really only comes into play in its current form around 1982. Is when the Supreme Court first articulates this idea that the only way you can hold a government official liable is if they violated a clearly established rule. And I think describing it that way sounds actually pretty reasonable, right? Like, if the rule wasn't established, it seems unfair to hold someone liable for violating a rule they couldn't know about. if the Supreme Court's going to change the rules, it's unfair to punish you for following a rule that didn't exist until the Supreme Court changed it. But I think what really drives our interest in this and the outrageousness of this doctrine is how it's actually applied on the ground. Because courts have taken this idea that a rule has to be clearly established, and they've turned it into a rule that says a government official can only be held liable if there's an earlier federal case in which someone did exactly the same thing in exactly the same circumstances, and the court said that violated the Constitution. And with the world being as complex as it is, that is almost impossible to find. You know, you can never step into the same river twice. You can never tackle the same guy on exactly the same lawn right. twice. And so what you see are cases that are genuinely outrageous. There was a case this past year out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals where the allegation was that officers serving a search warrant just stole a bunch of money and rare coins. They just took it for themselves, stole it from the property owner, and the Ninth Circuit said, well, there's no case we can find saying it violates your constitutional rights when the police just flat out steal your stuff. And the opinion actually had to make clear that, you know, they're aware that, you know, most human societies have generally frowned on
thousands of years of teaching.
So thousands of years of teaching, but no federal appellate decision. And as we all know, federal appellate decisions are the sole source of moral reasoning. And there was a similar case, again, not that long ago, where the 11th Circuit actually had a case on point that said it violated the Constitution for officers to sic a dog on a suspect who was in the process of surrendering. But nonetheless, when someone sued and said, I was surrendering and the police sicked their dog on me, the 11th Circuit said, well, here we have to award qualified immunity because in the last case, the suspect was lying down in surrendering, and here you were seated with your hands up. And so it's this doctrine that kind of treats government officials as if they're moral monsters who cannot be trusted to engage in any reasoning or any sort of understanding of principles, but can only be held liable if a federal court has specifically instructed them that someone in these precise circumstances violated the Constitution. And it's been used as a shield against liability for all sorts of officials across the spectrum.
Right. And it's just completely different than the rule for most citizens, which are citizens are assumed to know the law. And if you break the law, you're still held responsible for it. That doesn't apply to government officials. And as one judge pointed out, too, the effect of modern qualified immunity doctrine is that the more outrageous the conduct of the government, the more likely it is that there won't be a specific decision on it, so the government officials will be able to get away from it. So let's bring Justin Wilson into the discussion here and talk about a little bit, Justin, about the announcement of our project last month and our first case under the project, the West case out of Idaho.
Sure. Thanks, Scott. So when we first heard about Shanice's case, Bob and I met in Idaho and went to go actually meet with her and see exactly what had happened to our house. This is one of the sort of important things to see people where they're at and where everything happened. And we met with Shanice and she started showing us around the house, and we just realized just how much damage had been done, not only to the house, but also to her life. So her case started a number of years ago when she was out running errands and came back and the police were surrounding her house. And of course she's going, what's going on? I've done nothing wrong, I can't figure this out. She talks to a police officer and they say, oh, well, we're looking for your ex-boyfriend. She said, I don't think he's in there. You can go look. And she gives the police her keys, says, go look. And then she has to go run and get her kid registered for school because there was a timeline she needed to get over there. While she was gone, the police never tried the door. They immediately started a standoff with a house that was empty. But that didn't stop them from pummeling it with these shotgun-fired tear gas grenades for hours. In fact, the standoff lasted, I think, over 8 hours. And in the end, there was no one inside. Her house was utterly destroyed. Every window was broken. All of her personal property was ruined by the tear gas residue. And her dog that was inside, Blue, thank God he survived after all of that tear gas. And so he had to spend the night in the Humane Society. And when the smoke had cleared, she was left to pick up the pieces. She spent days and days scrubbing the walls, trying to get the tear gas residue off of it. She said she had to wear a respirator, her eyes would burn, and she could only work for so many hours inside the house. She showed us a bag that was just filled with broken glass that she'd pulled out of a baby crib. In fact, she was 9 months pregnant when this happened. And so with basically all of her worldly possessions ruined, covered in this toxic substance, and the house slowly being repaired, she finally said, I need to hold these people accountable. And so she sued. And she won an initial ruling, but because of the qualified immunity doctrine, the police were able to immediately appeal it to the appeals court, where she lost. And that's where we took the case.
Right. So we took it over. And Bob, talk a little bit about our joining this case and what we're asking the Supreme Court to do, and if they take it up, what will be at issue?
Absolutely. So we're taking this case up to ask the Supreme Court to really start to rein in these gross excesses of the qualified immunity doctrine. And I think the opinions you see in the appellate court in this case illustrate exactly what the problem is. Shanice lost 2-1. There was a dissenting opinion. And the dissent said, I think, basically what you would want a court to say here, which is, ordinarily, if the police are going to do something like this, they need a warrant. And the only exception to needing a warrant is if you have consent. That's a clearly established rule, and it's also established that consent is limited to the scope of the consent you actually got, and no competent human being would understand an invitation to go inside a house as an invitation to stand outside the house bombarding it with tear gas grenades. All of us have invited people into our homes.
Seems like a reasonable proposition.
Exactly. We all know that when we invite someone to dinner, we're not inviting them to bombard our house with tear gas grenades. But what the majority said is, no, that's not the question. It doesn't matter whether a reasonable human being or a competent officer could have understood consent to go into the home as consent to destroy it. What matters is whether there's an existing case where this happened. And indeed, no one has ever argued that consent to go into the home is consent to destroy it from the outside. And because no one's argued it, no court has ever rejected it. And because no court has ever rejected it, these people are entitled to qualified immunity, and Shanice is out of luck. It's exactly the situation you mentioned, where the most egregious cases just don't get decided because it doesn't occur to anyone to say, when you invited me in, that meant I could come in with incendiary devices.
Right, and I think it's important to point out, too, that this is an ironclad rule. This is not, well, what's the level of culpability and what should go on with it? This is just a rule that comes down when qualified immunity or other types of immunity kicks in that says, under no set of circumstances will then the government be liable for the wrongdoing that occurred.
That's exactly right. What the majority opinion actually expressly says is it's not saying that this was a reasonable thing to do, but it doesn't matter if this was a reasonable thing to do. It doesn't matter how unreasonable it was. It just matters if there's an existing case that's been decided.
Right, and therefore no compensation at all.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Justin, let's turn back to you too, to talk a little bit more about the interest in this case and this issue. And as I indicated earlier in the discussion, that this is starting to become an issue that is cutting across the ideological spectrum, and where there's a lot of interest and concern about this in many different quarters.
Yeah, I mean, as we've talked about, there is definitely a lot of interest in the court of law. But, you know, we know that in public interest law, that also cuts through to the court of public opinion. And traditionally, a lot of these issues have become, unfortunately, polarized as being either pro-police or anti-police, because oftentimes it involves police taking action against an individual. And there's a limit to that, though, because there's a lot of people who immediately sort of turn off when they hear that that's the framing for an issue. And what IJ brings to the table is the ability to articulate how this is about more than just this one polarized issue. And as a group that is a group that defends the Constitution, we have to recognize that there are constitutional limits on government power. And we're not the only ones doing that. You've seen David French at the National Review. You've seen Justice Don Willett. But you've also seen people like Bernie Sanders questioning qualified immunity. And so now, as we move forward with this project, we're starting to tie all these pieces together to create an understanding in the broader public dialogue that this is an issue that needs to be addressed by the courts, by opinion leaders, and by others.
And I think it's important to point out, too, that it's not just the police either. This can apply to really any government officials, from inspectors to police officers to FBI agents. It's across the board. And there really is this, as I said, broad cross-sectional interest in the issue. And it's also something, Bob, too, that it seems like the Supreme Court and various justices are interested in this issue. And so that's another thing that drove our thinking on this, is that not only was the issue important where we felt like IJ could make a really unique contribution, but where the timing was right, too.
I think that's right. I think the timing is right. And again, I think Justin's exactly right that we bring unique things to the table here. And it's another thing that is so appealing about taking Shanice West's case, because this is fundamentally a case about property rights. What happened here is government officials trespassed on Shanice's land. They came into her home without her consent. They destroyed her home without her consent. And that is something that for hundreds of years, the courts have stood ready to give you a remedy for. And I think it illustrates really how this doctrine that frequently has been debated in this sort of pro-police, anti-police format has metastasized and is starting to eat all of these other constitutional rights that all of us care about. And so IJ can really bring to the table an argument that not only sort of justices on the left who might be more amenable to arguments about police conduct can listen to, but arguments that Justice Thomas, for example, has expressly asked for. Justice Thomas, just a couple years ago, issued an opinion in which he said, I want to reconsider the court's qualified immunity doctrine. I don't think it has historical roots. I don't think it has enough historical grounding. But I want to do so in a context where I can be confident that what I'm deciding is something that would have been actionable at the time of the framing. And that's a great thing we can do in Shanice's case, is we have, you know, this laundry list of 19th century cases and 19th century treatises. You know, one of the fun things you get to do at IJ is you read a lot of 19th century treatises on the law of negligence, but really establish that there was no presumption that someone coming onto your land without a warrant from a court was entitled to any protection, whether they worked for the government or not. That the court's approach was, the first thing is, that's a trespass. And once you've proven a trespass, it's up to the defendant to sort of prove the trespass was justified. And in modern times, we've turned that on its head, where undeniably there was a trespass, undeniably your property was destroyed, but we're not going to look to the government to ask for justification. We're going to start from the presumption that they're allowed to do that just because of where they work.
Right. And the court has been taking a more property rights approach to the Fourth Amendment, which is something we're becoming increasingly interested in as well and trying to exploit then too. So as I mentioned, this is the start of our work in this area. We're soon going to be announcing our involvement in a case touching on immunity issues with the use of these federal and state task forces that are growing throughout the country and where abuses and a lack of accountability run rampant. And like we have for so many other issues, we'll use all the tools of public interest litigation to alter the course of the law on this issue. And our long-term goal is to ensure that when officials abuse their power and violate constitutionally protected rights, they will be held accountable by citizens who have viable remedies in court for pursuing wrongdoing.
Great. Thank you, Scott. With that, I'd like to turn to some questions from our listeners. We will be taking live questions, so if you're on the line and you have a question for Scott, Justin, or Bob, just press star on your phone and we will add you to the queue. We did have a number of questions that were submitted in advance, so we'll get to those first. But again, just press star and you can ask your question live. So first, we had a question from Roger in Colorado. And he said, what do you think are the best arguments in favor of government immunity, and what are your responses to them?
So I think probably the best argument I've heard is that stripping away this doctrine will put the police in an untenable position, where the police are frequently in these sort of hair-trigger situations where they have to make rapid decisions, and if they're going to be held liable for getting that decision wrong every time, they're going to just stop protecting the public. And it's an argument I have some intuitive sympathy for. I mean, I come from a law enforcement family. I certainly understand where that argument's coming from. But I also think that the answer to that argument lies in what IJ's actually advocating for. Because fundamentally, we think the touchstone should be reasonableness. It should be what the dissent in the Shanice West case said. Is there any way a competent officer might have thought he was following the law here? And that is an inquiry that is grounded in sort of traditional concepts that people have to act reasonably, that the touchstone of the common law is the reasonable man or the reasonable person. And I think that is already baked into these sort of hair trigger situations. The problem with the doctrine we actually have is it's expanded way beyond that. In Shanice's case, for example, as Justin said, it was an hours-long standoff. The police had plenty of time to think about what they were doing. They had plenty of time to call a lawyer and get legal advice, which they actually did in this case. They called the lawyer and said, if we have consent, do we need to get a warrant to go in? And the lawyer said no, and so they hung up with the lawyer. And then they changed their mind and said, we shouldn't go in. Instead of going in, we should bombard the house from the outside, and just didn't call the lawyer back. And so in these situations, it seems like it's much fairer to just ask whether they're acting reasonably, taking into account how much time they had to make the decision, how difficult the decision was. I don't think anyone's arguing for a strict liability standard here, but what we can do is move to a standard that has something more to do with reality, instead of this, frankly, somewhat fanciful rule that imagines that every government official is carefully parsing the wording of every federal court opinion and then using that court opinion and only that court opinion as a guide to rightful action. I think we'll come to a rule that's much less arbitrary, much more understandable, and much more just if we return to a basic idea of reasonableness instead of just this mechanical, is there a case with exactly these facts, which is what the doctrine has devolved into.
All right. One more that was submitted in advance. We have some questions coming in, so we'll get to those next. Michael in D.C. had a question about the scope of the project. He noted, you know, the IJ's focus has traditionally been within our four pillars, economic liberty, property rights, school choice, free speech. And he asked, do you see this new focus as establishing a fifth pillar, or does that depend on the opportunities that arise and the court cases that are available?
Well, this is certainly a new project for IJ. It's not a new pillar. And what it characterizes this issue is it really cuts across all of our pillars. It's about the abuse of power. And a lot of the cases we'll be taking on are really related directly to current issues that we're litigating, like I said, fines and fees and civil forfeiture. And then also, like in the West case, the Fourth Amendment that we also defend, and this is really the West case and many others we'll get involved in, are really property rights issues as well. The police in this case grossly violated Ms. West's property rights. And what we also look for in a lot of our cases, too, are ones that kind of cut across our pillars as well. A lot of our free speech issues involve entrepreneurs that are trying to earn an honest living, but they're doing that by speaking freely about important issues then as well. So I would put this new project into that camp, and it's one that, as I said, it's really necessary for us to be involved in, and where there's a lot of opportunity for us to make a real impact on the law in areas that we care passionately about.
All right. Our next question will be from Alan in New York. Alan, you are live. What is your question?
Two prongs. One, isn't it possible, given how egregious some of these cases are, to shame them, to advertise what the people are doing, to at least try to get some restitution? But secondly, this case that you mentioned that you're starting with is so egregious, and there are certain aspects of it that maybe you could win without overturning the principle. I'm a little concerned that it doesn't really address overturning the principle, but just certain egregiencies of this case.
No, so I think that's always a concern with cases like this, and you're not wrong. IJ projects always operate in terms of years and decades rather than weeks and months, and we always look to start with sort of the thinnest end of the wedge we can. And this is an area where there is, as Scott said, sort of growing public outcry, but there's also a lot of resistance on the Supreme Court to changing anything. And so we're looking for the most egregious case to sort of start prying open the doctrine. We're certainly going to reach for the biggest ruling we can get in this case, but you know, it's important to view every case as a building block, and this is not a standalone case. It's not the only case we even have right now, and it's not the only case we're going to have over the coming years. So if we do only get a narrow ruling here, it's a narrow ruling we're going to use to build on. And if we get a broader ruling here, frankly, it's a broader ruling we're going to use to build on. And I think the public shame is, unfortunately, not always as effective as you would want it to be. I mean, the behavior here was egregious. Shanice was homeless for 2 months, and I think the best way to encapsulate the degree of shame the local government felt is she was homeless for 2 months, and they offered her compensation by giving her a hotel voucher for 3 weeks. So slightly less than half of the time she was homeless, they put her up in a hotel, and they thought that made them square.
All right. Next question is from Roger in Massachusetts. Roger, you're live. What's your question?
Hi there. Yeah, thank you. You know, really exciting initiative. I'm very excited about it personally. I was wondering if there would be any sort of strategic move given the broad ideological saliency of this issue to, you know, join forces formally or informally with other organizations that might be interested. And, you know, I understand that would be a shift, perhaps, but maybe an opportune one.
Yeah, Roger, we always look for those opportunities, and we're already doing that. We started doing that in some of our amicus work in this area, where we had this broad cross-section of ideological groups, where we teamed up with Cato and the ACLU, for instance. And we always try to attract that and to work with people of goodwill, no matter where they might be, still staying principled and still taken from our perspective, not their perspective. But I think this is an issue like civil forfeiture and eminent domain abuse and now, thankfully, occupational licensing, where you do see a number of people, maybe they look at this from a slightly different perspective, but they're coming to the same conclusion that this is just fundamentally wrong. And Bob is right, too. What's also the strength of this issue and what I think we can bring to the table, and I think those are more on the left side recognize, is the fact that you can make a very strong originalist case against qualified immunity. That the history of this is that citizens have long been, it's long been established that citizens can sue government officials and hold them accountable. This is not the product of war and court activism from the 50s and 60s. This is something that has existed from the common law up through the early days of the founding of the Republic. And so, and that is why you have justices like Justice Thomas that look at this and say, you know, I might be concerned about some of the policy implications of this, but I'm an originalist, and I have to look at what the meaning of the Constitution was, and we want to take advantage of people with that perspective then, too.
All right. Next question is from Patricia in Minnesota. Patricia, you are live. What is your question?
My question is, supposing that IJ is successful and the qualified immunity is substantially changed and reduced, then the question comes, will the government officials be held to be personally responsible? What I am concerned about is, consider the police case. They learn about the problem of immunity being diminished. They get the budget for the police department to increase. And then what happens is, when a police officer is successfully sued, he doesn't pay anything, he or she. Instead, the budget pays for it. And so ultimately, people are paying for their taxes. Is this what you want or not? And what about this?
No, I think that's absolutely a valid concern, and it's something we've thought a lot about in terms of what the actual downstream consequences of winning will be. And people have done robust studies of sort of where the money comes from when government officials are actually held liable. And it turns out to generally not be the pocket of the individual, and also not from just the overall department line item, but that these risks are paid by insurance companies. They're insurable. And so what you'd hope and expect would happen is that as insurance companies see more exposure, they take action to say your premiums are going to go up. They take a greater interest in sort of training government officials have to go through. Right now, the rule is essentially that no one is liable and all of the burden has to fall on the victim of the constitutional violation. Removing these immunities actually shifts the burden up to the insurance company, which frankly has a greater ability to police these things on the front end and look to people's behavior.
All right, we have time for one more question, and I wanted to get to one that was submitted in advance. And if you had a question that we weren't able to get to, if you're on the phone, you can just stay on the line and leave us a voicemail, and we will get back to you, or you can email me, and we'll get back to you that way as well, because we do want to answer everyone's question. The one that was in advance is from Jim in North Carolina, who was curious about which kinds of immunity apply to different types of government officials. He mentioned prosecutors, also asked about what about incompetent coroners or lab people. Like, what would happen in that instance?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one that it's a kind of a complicated answer because there's different levels of immunity, and we haven't even really gotten completely into that in this call. And it differs as what level of government you're in. As well. For instance, we were talking largely about qualified immunity. There's also the doctrine of absolute immunity that many judicial officials and, frankly, prosecutors enjoy as well, which is outrageous, and where you see instances where prosecutors make decisions that directly impact people's lives. And even if they're sometimes blatantly violating the law or abusing their power in a pretty egregious way, they're not held responsible for it because of this even heightened immunity that's beyond qualified immunity. There's also differences in between federal officials and state officials. Under state and local officials, you can sue under Section 1983, which provides at least some basis for pursuing these claims. Under federal law, you have to pursue what's called a Bivens action against federal officials. And unfortunately, the federal courts have been curtailing Bivens actions now for a number of decades, which makes it extremely difficult to sue federal agents directly, even though, as we were talking about earlier, there is a robust history of citizens being able to sue federal officials in state and federal courts since the founding days of the Republic. So it oftentimes turns on who the official is, what level of immunity that they have, and we're looking to have IJ's work impact immunity on all levels.
Great. Thanks, Scott, and thank you to everyone who is listening. With that, we're out of time. If you had, as I mentioned, a question that we weren't able to get to, you can email me and we will get back to you. I will personally sit outside Scott's office until he responds. You can also stay on the line and leave a voicemail. Thank you so much to Justin, Bob, and Scott. And thank you to everyone who called in. Have a great evening.